So the first talk we have is Dr. Craig Neuschafer from Drexel University, who will talk about parental age and give a review of the topic along with some of the complications involved in analyses. Our second speaker is Dr. Stephen Buca from Brown University, who will talk about meta-analysis and how it can address a lot of the challenges involved with perinatal and neonatal risk factors for autism. Our third speaker is Dr. Igor Burstein from Drexel University, who will talk about environmental pollutants with the specific case example of maternal smoking during pregnancy. And finally, our last speaker will be Dr. Lisa Krohn from Kaiser Permanente, who will talk about maternal prescription drug use. So I guess with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Neuschafer.
Great. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for sticking around. I see a lot of familiar faces. How many in the audience consider themselves engaged in epidemiologic risk factor research? And how many are sort of learning more about this? Okay. Well, pitch this a little bit more towards the folks who are sort of approaching this for the first time. So those of you who are enmeshed in this, hopefully this is still useful. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start with a just very quick two-slide summary of the state of the findings with respect to parental age and autism risk. Then I'm going to categorize major methodological challenges faced in epidemiologic risk factor studies in general. And I agree with Brian's point that different topics sort of amplify different challenges. But I think in some sense, too, every observational study of a potential risk factor has to consider some of these common challenges. So I'll list those out, and I'll give some examples with respect to research on the parental age effect. And I'll highlight some of the alternative approaches that were taken in this line of research and some of the challenges that are still faced there. And I'll just close a little bit talking about some of the etiologic implications of the parental age work and sort of where research might be going. So we're fortunate in that to summarize findings on the parental age effect, if you're interested in paternal age or maternal age, there have been two very recent reviews. I won't go into the reviews in great detail. Dr. Buca is going to talk a little bit about some of the specific challenges in doing a comprehensive research synthesis. But the first one is the paper by Haltman from 2010 that summarized the findings on the paternal age effect. Focused on population-based studies, general population comparison groups, estimates that could be pooled, etc. So if you look at this forest plot that presents the results from the individual studies with the dark dots and then the summary estimates with this shaded diamond, if you will, we see the general pattern of the effect here. The reference group is dads who are 29 or younger. And this first category is a little hard to read for those of you out here. This is the 30 to 39-year-old dads, the 40 to 49-year-old dads, and over age 50. And you can see one thing that you'll note, the scale here for the odds ratio effect estimate is a log scale. So we see sort of a linear effect on the log scale. So there's a suggestion of a monotonic relationship between paternal age and autism risk. And to give you an idea of magnitude, the summary estimate here for this higher category, the dads over 50, is about 2.5 or so. For the moms, an article just came out by basically the same groups, a different constellation of authors, in the Journal of Academies of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, excuse me. Same basic criteria for including studies, general population comparison groups, comparable ways to pool the maternal age effects. The findings here, the graphic is not as delightful as the earlier graphics. These are the individual study results. They're a little hard to see. The pooled results, also a little hard to see for those of you in the back. So the reference category here is the 25 to 29-year-old moms. And again, it's a little tough, especially because they have this very large scale, because this was in the same figure as the individual studies. But basically, here are the younger moms under 20. These are the moms 30 to 34, and these are the older moms, age 35 and older, in this particular meta-analysis. And again, you sort of see the suggestion of monotonic relationship on a log scale with risk increasing with older maternal age. In another review, the review by Gardner that Steve was a co-author on, they came up summary estimates for a 5-year increase in maternal and paternal age effects, and they came up with a 7% increase in risk for 5 years of maternal parental age and and 4% for 5 years intervals of paternal age. Okay, so what about the challenges that have to be faced in this study, or a study really of any other epidemiologic risk factor studies, observational studies? So this is going to be familiar to most of you here: selection bias, confounding, information bias, precision, and then the idea of once you think you've got a nice valid estimate of a main effect, you probably want to think about more complex causal mechanisms. Is there effect modification? Are there mediators? Is your effect specific to some subgroup of kids with autism or not? So these are the things that have to be confronted in paternal age research as well. So I want to talk a little bit about selection bias. Hasn't been elevated as a huge issue in this particular line of research, in part because one of the advantages of a lot of the work that's been done on parental age is that the data can come from large population-based registries or healthcare systems where there's generally thought to be fairly good representation. But I want to talk about selection bias because I think it's a little bit underappreciated, and I think I have an example that maybe is just a heuristic example, but it's potentially something that we might actually want to think about for realsies with respect to parental age and other prenatal risk factors. So the idea of selection bias is just if the rectangle represents the true source population, and the sub-rectangles represent the groups of the true source population partitioned into ASD, no ASD, and then older and younger parent. Right? As long as there's no population level confounding, what we would see here is we'd see a population level association between older parental age and autism risk. It would suggest that because there's more older parents in the ASD group as a proportion than in the no ASD group, it would suggest that there's a true population association here as long as there's no population level confounding. So we do studies, we sample, and so when we sample from, we take a subset of the true population, and in this case, the idea of selection bias is that your sampling fractions are essentially equal across all your cells. And so this cartoon shows basically we're getting 25% of the source population, and if you make inference by looking at the ratio of older parents to younger parents in the ASD and non-ASD groups in your sample, you get the same inference, right? That there's an association because a higher proportion of parents of kids with ASD are older. So the selection bias comes when there's differential sampling with respect to both your exposure of interest and your outcome. So in this quasi-hypothetical example, I suggest that there might be lower representation from the quadrant where there are older parents of affected children. And now if we made inference looking at the sample, we might see no effect because it looks like there's about the same proportion of older parents to younger parents in both groups, right? So that's what selection bias is. Just to think about it a little bit, I also wanted to introduce this idea of directed acyclic graphs. And I don't have time to talk about the methods behind DAGs, but in the audience, familiar with DAGs, use DAGs, love DAGs, committed to DAGs. All right, some. For those of you who aren't, I mean, it's gaining traction in the field, and it's a way, it's just, you might have heard of these things in other disciplines as causal diagrams connecting independent and dependent variables with arrows, but the DAG approach has some formal rules for doing this and can really help reveal confounding variables that you should adjust for, variables that maybe you shouldn't adjust for, and can illustrate things like selection bias. So I'll give you a reference that I recommend that it's something maybe you want to look at in terms of thinking about your work on prenatal risk factors. So with respect to selection bias, so the idea here is there is selection in our studies. In fact, that we study kids who are live born. And we know that older parental age is associated with increased fetal loss, right? So there's a negative association between older parental age and live birth. Now, what I guess we don't really know if the pathophysiology underlying ASD might also be associated in some way with fetal fitness. I don't think we know this, but in perinatal epidemiology, this is something that's often considered. And I really haven't heard many folks consider this, but if it's a possibility, it could be that the pathophysiology associated with ASD is also associated with fetal loss. So there's this negative relationship between ASD and live birth. And in the DAG world, what happens is when you control for something, and we can control for something either by adjusting for it or by stratifying on it. So when we're only studying live births, we're essentially stratifying and doing stratified analysis only on live-born kids, and we don't observe anything about those kids who weren't lucky enough to be born alive. You indicate that by boxing. And so when we box this off, what it does is it basically opens up this pathway. So there now could be an association between older parental age and ASD that's a result just of this selection, right, that we did that we didn't observe here. So if you found this compelling and exciting and it made the afternoon worthwhile not being outside and coming here today, there's a couple of references. Miguel Hernan writes some very understandable articles about using DAGs. One's particular to selection bias, and then there's another one particular to perinatal epidemiology applications, and I recommend this. So what about confounding? We're all familiar with confounding, and I think in terms of what's been paid attention to with parental age literature, there's been a lot of attention paid to confounding. The age of the other parent is a paternal age effect independent of a maternal age effect. Genetic liability operating potentially through something like broad autism phenotype. Are parents who are more likely to have children later, do they have some genetic liability that moves through the broad autism phenotype that brings that about? And if those genes are passed on to their kids, it might also create, it might confound the potential relationship between parental age and autism risk. There are other potential confounders that have been considered as well, and I'll return and talk a little bit about factors correlated with calendar time a little bit later in the presentation. So if we wanted to continue, you know, breaking out our DAGs, you know, this would be a DAG that illustrates the potential relationship with genetic liability in older parental age. The DAG suggesting there's no real relationship here, but if the genetic liability is associated with older parental age and also associated with ASD risk, if you did not control for genetic liability, there would be the appearance of an association. And then this is the situation with separating out the effects of paternal and maternal age. They're correlated, perhaps not causally, but older dads go with older moms. So there's an association there, and same idea. If we don't mutually control for these things, we might not have an unconfounded estimate of the independent effect. So I want to talk a little bit more about the age of parent confounding because it's tied to another methods challenge concept, which is the idea of multicollinearity. And I think there's some confusion around the idea of multicollinearity. So multicollinearity is a specific situation where if we're trying to unpack the association of an independent variable of interest and a potential confounder, we expect that they're correlated. That's why we're worried that it's a potential confounder. Multicollinearity happens when the correlation is extraordinarily high. And there's no set rule, but some rule of thumbs, you know, what I see most commonly is a correlation coefficient of 0.9 or above. When that happens, when you try to adjust for these correlated exposures in models, you can get a dramatic influence on the precision of your estimates. So you get very, very broad 95% confidence intervals. Doesn't affect the validity of your estimate, but your confidence limits can get extraordinarily broad. And that makes results more difficult to interpret, and it also means when you have imprecision that you're more likely, your point estimate is more likely to be a chance finding. So it's a worry, but it really is something that comes into play when correlation is really quite high. So I'll talk about one study now as an example of the most common approach for dealing with confounding by the age of the other parent. And just to note, in this study, the study by Shelton et al., using California data, the correlation between maternal and paternal age was about 0.7. So it's high, but not really in the red light flashing danger zone for multicollinearity. And the other thing you notice about this study, which is representative of a lot of studies in this area, is that it was a big study. There were 5 million subjects. This was California, a birth certificate defined cohort, and DDS data to find autism cases. And the approach that they took a modeling approach, and I realize this will be hard to see, but they were also able to take a stratification approach. So the top set of boxes are the maternal age effect stratified by dad's age. So younger dads, older dads, and this is the increasing maternal age effect, and you see that in all the strata of paternal age. And then this is the opposite. This is the paternal age effect within the boxes, and these are younger moms and older moms. And you see, again, for most part, the consistent maternal age effect in all the cells. And then they also were able to run a multivariable model mutually adjusting for these effects and found that both effects remained. Interestingly, so King et al. Used the same data source, basically, different years, again about 5 million, so a big study population, and they had an additional wrinkle. It was also a confounding question, and this is going to translate into another methodologic concern. So one of the other points I wanted to make is that oftentimes methodologic concerns are not completely independent, and the study isn't challenged by one. They sort of pile on each other. So King et al. Was concerned with joint confounding. They were worried about essentially confounding by secular trend. So again, going back to the DAG approach, here's the problem of separating out maternal or paternal age effects. But they also noted that on average, age of parents is going up with calendar time, and so too is at least ASD prevalence. So there's this joint confounding involved, and they wanted to be able to implement an analysis that controlled for both the opposite parent's age and also calendar time, secular trend. And they were a little bit worried about using categorical parameterizations. They wanted to make use of all the data that was in the parental age span. So they wanted to do continuous parameterizations. And they introduced something in their paper, which is a little unfamiliar to epidemiologists. I won't go into it in detail, but it's been used again in subsequent analyses. They used this decomposition approach for parameterizing the parental age effects. Instead of entering mom's age effect and dad's age effect as continuous terms, they put in separate terms for the sum of the parental age and the difference of the parental ages. And those are less correlated, and you can also back out of the equations the estimates of the continuous maternal and paternal age effect. So they did this because they were worried about multicollinearity, even though we saw in this data set the correlation was around 0.7, not quite 0.9. But what happens is they got into the area of doing categorical and continuous parameterizations of the age effect. And so this is their results when they did the continuous parameterizations. This is stratified by birth year. So this is the way they're essentially adjusting out the cohort effect. So you've got a separate paternal and maternal age effect, a continuous parameterization. So these relative risks are fairly small. This is 1.02 if you can't read it from where you're sitting, and this is about 1.045 if you can't read it from where you're sitting. And so for the dad's age effect, they said, look, you know, it doesn't really look like there's a paternal age effect, but it looks like there's a maternal age effect. So their conclusion was that it was the maternal age effect persists, the paternal age effect when you adjust for secular trend, and maternal age effect goes away. Now, interesting here, I mean, one thing to bear in mind is that if we go back to those estimates from the Gardner meta-analysis, the annual age effect, the effect of getting 1 year older, would be very small. It would be less than 1%. So it would be down here in this range. And so it falls within sort of the confidence limits of this parental age effect that they consider null, which is one issue. The other interesting issue is, so they also did the categorical parameterization, right? And so here they looked at a cut point, same cut point for moms and dads over and under age 40, and this is the paternal age effect and the maternal age effect. So when they dichotomized parental age this way, they did see an effect of paternal age, and they did see an effect of maternal age. The magnitude of the paternal age effect is a little lower, but it's clearly there in terms of over 40 versus under 40. So this raises another issue, another methodological challenge, which is really information bias related to how we parameterize our exposure variables and also our confounding variables. And Igor is going to talk more about other information bias problems in his talk. But again, I think most of you in the audience are sort of aware of this, but just for fun, you know, this illustrates some difficulty that we can have trying to implement different parameterizations for an exposure, in this case parental age. So if this is the true risk relationship between parental age and ASD risk on a log scale, and I'm not suggesting that this is it, this is a hypothetical example, if we set up, if we parameterized in terms of categories based on, say, quintiles of age, and used a dummy variable parameterization and called, you know, the youngest age group the reference, fit a model to that, right, as you all know, we would see something like this. We would capture the basic shape of this risk relationship. You know, we'd see here that the relative risks are close to 1 compared to the reference group, and then once we got up to these upper two quintiles, we'd see the big effects of being you know, a much older parent. But if we chose to categorize using tertiles, what would happen, right? We would, if we made the lowest tertile the reference group, we would have basically these relative risk estimates, and this would appear to us, just interpreting the pattern of these two relative risk estimates, that maybe there was this monotonic increase in the parental age effect when the true risk relationship is this curve that I've drawn. And this would do no better than would a continuous parameterization, which would also fit a line on the log scale. So What's the right parameterization for parental age effects? I don't think we really know yet. There's only been one study in that same Hultman review. They also published a new analysis of some Swedish registry data. And this is the first time I've seen somebody try to fit sort of a spline model, you know, it doesn't make any assumptions about the shape of the risk relationship to a parental age data, in this case paternal age data. And they came up with this shape. And you know, I think that this is an area that we need to think a little bit more carefully about as we move forward with our work on parental age, because the shape of this curve could have implications for some of the etiologic questions we want to ask to follow up on this relationship. So what about the challenge of understanding more complex causal mechanisms? I don't have time to go into a lot of this in detail, but I think also, even though we've had multiple studies, meta-analyses, and big populations that can support this work, there are a lot of unanswered questions when we think about effect modification with respect to parental age, and also when we think about effect specificity. I highlighted some of the smorgasbord of findings related to effect modification and related to effect specificity that we've seen. There's been some investigation of effect modification by parity, some by whether or not there's interaction between the maternal and paternal and age terms, some by gender, etc. Thank you, Brian. But there's really more work that needs to be done in this area for sure. And the challenge is, I think, making sure that the data sets that allow us to estimate the main effects of parental age also have the variables in place that let us explore some of these interactions. So closing with some thoughts about implications for etiology. So again, I think we're interested in estimating the parental age effect. I guess there are some public health and potential clinical implications, but I think it's got its most traction because we want to think about what it tells us about autism etiology. And as many of you are familiar with, there are some interesting hypotheses related to these with the paternal age effect. There's been some thinking that this could be driven by de novo mutation or epigenetic mechanisms, and we know that there's a proven paternal age effect with schizophrenia, and so that suggests that perhaps there's some common underlying etiologic mechanisms maybe that could be explored. With the maternal age effect, we know that there's an established relationship between older maternal age and poor birth outcomes, low birth weight, and obstetric complications, and so that begs the question, are these things mediators in the parental age effect of autism? And that's been explored to some extent. And we also know that the maternal age effect might somehow be associated to diminished capacity to maintain an optimal intrauterine environment, and maybe making that environment more susceptible to xenobiotics or other exogenous risk factors. So there are implications for etiology, and I think that if we were to sort of put our thinking cap on, and again, I'll return now to the DAG on steroids, right? Try to everybody's really tired, aren't they? I thought I was sure the DAG on steroids joke was going to get at least a chuckle from the rostrum here, but anyhow. So here I've just sort of freestyled a little bit in terms of here's the parental age, here's the ASD, and trying to think about really what could be going on here, going back to genetic liability and thinking about it in terms of common variants and rare variants that are inherited. You know, these could be related to that broad autism phenotype. This could go around to suboptimality. If these are passed on to the child, genetic liability in the child, common variants, that could be directly related to ASD. You know, so we can really try to think this through a little more carefully. The question is, can we bring the data to bear that will help us sort of work off of a complicated DAG like this? I think in the near term, there are some things that are going to move the field forward. The iCare collaboration that's been mentioned at this meeting a number of times is bringing together registry data. So even though these are big studies to begin with, and they've done a lot of the important, interesting initial work on parental age, having that data pooled will allow to get at some of these questions that require even more power, such as elucidating the shape of those parental age effects and looking at some of the interactions. And then I think we'll see some more focused hypothesis-based studies looking at the mechanisms underlying the parental age effect. And I think that these will be sort of facilitated in coming years by the studies that, again, we've heard a lot about at this meeting that are underway that are linking biomarkers to sort of large population samples like the work that Lisa does in EMA and other studies of that nature. So while we may not be able to unpack that DAG I drew on the last slide, I think we'll inch our way forward over the next few years. So that's it. There's my email again if anyone's interested in contacting me. And I just wanted to acknowledge that this was a little bit of a riff on a version of a presentation I gave last year at this workshop sponsored by Wayne State. So thank you.
questions, or are we doing it?
Any questions?
All right. Well,
I guess so. There was a paper by Mortensen's group published recently on paternal age and schizophrenia, and that was basically using it within family design. They found that if you, within the family, the risk of schizophrenia to subsequent births after the first birth, there was no effect, basically. Effectively, they were controlling for, you know, the father, essentially.
Right.
And their argument was they were controlling for the genetic liability. But I wonder whether that same kind of thing could be done or should be done in autism to get at that question of confounding by genetic liability.
So in autism, the main attempts to control out genetic liability have been in the Scandinavian registry-based studies, and they've basically just tried to adjust for history of parental psychiatric disorders, which is sort of a weak approach. There has been one family study, also in that Holtman paper, which was it had a meta-analysis and it had two independent studies in one paper. I don't know, so nobody taught them that you should have published three times with that. I don't understand. But there was a family study there, and that was very interesting. And one of the things that they also did in that paper was they looked at, it was the one paper that tried to unpack whether or not the parental age effect might just be deferred paternity. Is it really just that the first child is older? And in fact, they were able to see that the parental age effect still applied in subsequent births in the family. So that was one thing that was done in the family studies in autism. But there haven't been very many. That's the only one I know of.
Well, thank you very much for this lovely presentation, especially the discussion about DAGs. My question is with regard to the possibility of having selection bias in these studies, and it seems it is inevitable somehow. So do you see any role for adjustment of selection bias by sensitivity analysis or like Marco Polo approach?
Yeah, sensitivity analyses have been employed in a number of the studies, usually not for selection bias control purposes, sometimes in the meta-analysis, as we may hear about a little later, they've been used to sort of take out some of the outliers. It's possible. I mean, I think that I don't know whether selection bias is inevitable here. I mean, I put that example up with selection driven by the necessity that we study live births. I mean, I think it's an empty question, an unanswered question as to whether or not there is an association between the pathophysiology underlying autism and live birth. You could certainly take an approach to basically try to see how strong that effect would have to be to make your results go away. And that's a sensitivity approach that could be used.
Thank you.
All right, great. Thank you very much.